Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, July 23rd. This week, officials with the European Union and International Monetary Fund, as well as some bankers and such, got together to decide the fate of Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, while also stemming further contagion to the likes of Italy and Spain, and, just as importantly, save their August holidays. It would appear, especially in terms of the last point, that it was mission accomplished. What they come back to in September and beyond, though, is anyone's guess. For now, all we know are the broad outlines of this new plan, a continuation of the Euro Ponzi scheme. But lest one be too cynical, there are some good features, and it gives three of the pigs a fighting chance, at least, if they stick to their own programs, and this is critical, their economies grow. Because none of the EU's best intentions will mean squat without growth, and as I've been writing since the crisis hit last year, I'm not talking the piddly kind or what PIMCO has been labeling the new normal, 2% type growth. Nope, we need 4% or better in the case of the pigs, including Italy and Spain, and just where that is going to come from amidst the austerity and without the titanic Churchill-like leadership required, I'll never know. But back to the details of Greek bailout 2 as we currently know them. The tax-dodging Greeks, who peaked about 2,000 years ago, are receiving another $157 billion on top of a similar earlier amount, plus a supposed $70 billion in private participation from the likes of banks and insurers, who are to roll over their current bond holdings for a menu of options, kind of like Applebee's, two entrees plus an appetizer for $20, only in some cases they'll also get a haircut thrown in. In essence, Greek bonds will have their maturities extended to as much as 30, I've also seen 40 years, versus the current 7.5-year benchmark. The 7.5-year will roll into a 15-year piece of scrip that will now pay an interest rate of 3.5% instead of 4.5% to 5.8%. This is a big key to the plan. Ireland and Portugal are receiving the same terms when their paper is rolled into new instruments, and these are legitimate savings. In the case of Ireland, it saw anywhere from 600 million to 800 million euros annually. But back to the private partnership angle, what cracks me up is I wrote a few weeks ago that the banks and insurance companies had already sold a lion's share of their sovereign debt to the likes of hedge funds, so what is left to be rolled over? We'll find out soon enough, won't we? Look, I can't begin to really know what happened on Thursday in Brussels, and I'm sure I'll have far more for next week and succeeding weeks and months to come, because this will be an evolving bailout just as it's been since spring of 2010. What the EU and IMF have done is present Greece and Ireland and Portugal with a window of opportunity. These nations have to grab it. At the same time, and very importantly, there is this arm of the EU that will get a ton of play in coming years, the European Financial Stability Facility and the EFSF, backstopped by 440 billion euros, though far more will likely be needed, now has the power to buy bonds in the secondary market in an emergency. Say contagion is spread to Italy, the EFSF can buy their paper to stabilize matters until the panic subsides. The FSF, I'm going to have a hell of a time the next few years with this, will also have the power to go in and support banks that may be critical to the Eurozone but are having problems. Ergo, the folks at the EFSF should be very busy in the future. Pardon me. On the issue of selective defaults in bailout 2, thus far Fitch Ratings has weighed in and called it a temporary default when it comes to Greece until the bailout cash is deposited and the mechanisms for meeting their new obligations are in place. Those playing the credit default swap market, hoping for Greece to default outright, are likely to be disappointed. The other ratings agencies have yet to chime in. Lastly, aside from the growth issue, everything that the EU has done this week, including an outright write-off of some of Greece's debt, still would leave the country in a perfect world and with solid growth, with a debt level at best of 120% of GDP around 2016. Of course, it'll be much higher than this. The issue is, when will the markets see through the fog and get back to taking shots at the pigs? Hopefully not until September at the earliest. Everyone could use a bit of a break. Editorial, Financial Times. The European summit on Thursday has resulted in a belated but still impressive step towards a resolution of the sovereign debt crisis. The measures were clearly more significant than the markets expected, but at the same time they have fallen short of a once-and-for-all resolution of Europe's debt problem. Several key compromises have been made, notably between the German government and the European Central Bank, and these have removed some previously immovable obstacles to progress. The institutional plumbing is therefore now in place to resolve the crisis completely, but this still leaves one crucial question: how much money will be sent down the pipes? On that, the summit offered no new guidance. So how can problems still arise for the three most troubled economies? In the case of Greece, it could happen because the government fails to stick to the budget tightening which has been agreed. The Eurozone would then either have to provide more money, or the Greek government would default on its official debt and possibly leave the Euro. That clearly remains a possibility. For Ireland and Portugal, there is plenty of debt left in private hands, and markets have seen what happens when a sovereign nation reaches the limit of its financing ability, i.e. sovereign default. But for as long as these two countries remain inside the program, they will be able to refinance their debt as it falls due, at low interest rates from the European Financial Stability Facility. This means that the markets cannot make the solvency position of these countries any worse by raising bond yields. Like Greece, these two countries might still be ultimately insolvent, but only if the pain of their budget tightening proves too much to bear inside the euro. As for Spain and Italy, the editorial in the Financial Times notes, until the amount of ammunition is increased, the existential threats to the Eurozone stemming from the two has not been removed. Sooner or later, the Eurozone will have to increase the resources available to the EFSF very substantially, or the markets will once again call its bluff. Mohamed El Arian, in an op-ed for the Financial Times, debt solvency, growth, and contagion have been and are at the core of the problems of Europe's periphery. They speak to both the causes of this painful homegrown crisis and to the manner in which it has been spreading. It is therefore highly encouraging that European leaders are finally taking more aggressive steps to address all three aspects. Firstly, on solvency, the program countries, Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, will now benefit from lower interest rates and a significant extension of loan maturities. Secondly, greater focus is being placed on promoting growth in the periphery, though this is still too restrained relative to what is required. Finally, contagion risk, especially for Italy, Spain, and the Europe-wide financial system, is being lowered through a new, flexible, and fast-disbursing credit facility available to both sovereigns and banks. That's the EFSF that he's talking about. El Arian continues, then there is the execution risk. Four parties will have to deliver simultaneously and in a focused fashion to make this package effective. Governments in core countries, Germany, Finland, and the Netherlands in particular, must convince their skeptical citizens that this is a good use of their hard-earned tax euros. The ECB must also come up with a skillful way to compensate for the balance sheet hit it will have to take at some point on account of its peripheral bond purchases and repo operations. Private banks must waste no time in taking advantage of favorable market reactions to raise additional capital. Finally, the peripheral economies must deliver an internal economic adjustment that is both substantial and acceptable in socio-political terms. It's Mohamed El Arian of PIMCO in the Financial Times. Turning to Washington, while the focus was on Europe Thursday, investors were still glaring at Congress and the White House as the August 2nd debt ceiling deadline got closer and closer. When the heck are these guys going to get together and actually do something, many of us mused. My man, Oklahoma Republican Senator Tom Coburn, who had returned to the Gang of Six, which put forward a $3.7 trillion plan of spending cuts and new revenues, actually said he had a plan for $9 trillion in debt reduction over the next 10 years. Coburn didn't expect Congress or the president to bite on all of it, but as he put it, pick half. But as I go to post, we were supposed to have had a plan that all parties could agree on by July 22nd to give everyone enough time to write it up before the deadline. But now House Speaker Boehner has walked out of the talks. Oh, sure, House Republicans voted on their own program that would raise the debt ceiling along with spending cuts and a balanced budget amendment, but they knew it wouldn't fly in the Senate, let alone the White House. And for their part, Democrats, who control the Senate, still haven't come up with a plan of their own, and their base keeps saying, you cut my entitlements and you'll rue the day you did. The bottom line is House Republicans don't want new taxes, Senate Democrats don't want entitlements cut, and it's seemingly impossible to bring the two sides together in the grand bargain that President Obama and some Senate and House leaders still want. In a Washington Post ABC News survey the other day, 80% of Americans are dissatisfied or angry about the way the federal government is working, up 11% in 1 month. Among Republicans, 58% say the GOP is too resistant to a deal. 6 in 10 overall say the deficit plan should include a combination of spending cuts and new taxes. But I guarantee many of these same folks would flip sides if their entitlements were impacted. Ditto the findings of an NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, which found that 58% support a $4 trillion package including cuts to entitlements. I just don't believe it. 36% favor a $2.5 trillion deal that holds the line on taxes. As to the picture on Wall Street and the overall economy, I'll comment on corporate earnings in a bit, but the bottom line is housing still sucks. Witness another lousy report on existing home sales for June, which peaked at an annualized rate of 7.08 million in 2005 and were at 4.91 million in 2010 and are running at a similar rate thus far this year. Housing was obviously a key driver in the boom times, and it's still not contributing today. Witness General Electric's lousy news on the appliance front, which is tied to the sector. Ovens and refrigerators operating best when under a roof with an electrical outlet as opposed to just sitting in a vacant lot. It's also apparent that the American consumer is still sick, the summer cold that won't go away. Many of us continue to deleverage amidst the uncertainty, but there is a price to pay, and it's called 9.2% unemployment. While many of us like that government, from the feds on down through the state and local levels have finally been facing budget realities, these are lost jobs, consumers not spending, etc. One thing that is worrisome on this front in terms of employment is whereas a year ago you saw two communities looking to share police and fire services, now you see three looking to combine their efforts. At least I'm noticing that increasingly in my area, and I'm sure it's not dissimilar to yours. So this retrenchment has a long ways to go. It's necessary, but painful. Lastly, economists once thought the economy would grow at 3.5% for 2011. We're about to get our first estimate of second quarter activity, and the consensus seems to be around 1.5%, following 1.9% for the first quarter. In other words, not exactly 3.5. And you have to try real hard to build a case for roaring growth in the second half. Just ain't going to happen, sports fans. Now, economists are saying for the 12 months, Q3 of 2011 through Q2 2012, 3% is more like it. There are a lot of people who would be ecstatic with that kind of performance, though it would probably guarantee an unemployment rate still well above 8% come November 2012. Stocks rebounded after falling the prior week, with the Dow Jones up 1.6% to 12,681, the S&P 500 up 2.2%, and NASDAQ ahead 2.5%. With the potential for another week of debt talks in Washington, however, there is no telling what the market will do. But last week it was about the EU coming up with a second bailout for Greece at all, and some solid earnings led by the likes of IBM, Apple, and Coca-Cola. Others, including some in the banking sector, were not so good. And then on Friday, Caterpillar alone was responsible for 50 Dow points to the bad, when it reported a slight earnings miss. GE was also okay, but not great. Congratulations to McDonald's for another fantastic report.
That's all for this week. I'll be back with you next Saturday. For further information, go to stocksandnews.com. Click on Week in Review. Have a great week. Take care.